Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 10th of December 2011 here in Japan. It is still the 9th of December 2011 back in Canada, where I'm honored to be joined on the line today by Paul Hellyer, a Canadian engineer, politician, a writer. He has served on the Privy Council. He has also been the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. And in 1997, he founded the Canadian Action Party. He's also the author of numerous books on Canada and globalization, including Goodbye Canada and One Big Party to Keep Canada Independent. So, Paul Hellyer, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us today.
Not at all. It's my pleasure.
All right. Well, let's start by talking about a brand new U.S.-Canada border agreement that was just announced earlier this week in a meeting between Prime Minister Harper and President Obama. And the press is hailing this as a brand new agreement that will facilitate trade across the border and create a more of a continental security perimeter. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what this border deal really is about and what it really signifies?
Well, I'm very hard to say when they give you so little information. The idea that has been put forward by the government is that it's the biggest deal since NAFTA. And frankly, I don't find that the least bit reassuring. And I know that they've been working at it for a long while and that the Prime Minister feels that it's a coup of some kind. But I don't remember any kind of a negotiation with the United States where they didn't wind up getting more out of it than we did. And I suspect that this is the case with the present agreement. I'm concerned by various aspects of it. I don't really like the idea of armed United States police all around the outside of our country and across the middle, probably. And I find that very disconcerting. And some of the small print or the fine print that has leaked out bothers me. It looks as if everything we do and say as individuals is going to be available by one means or another to the American officials and the people there who are paranoid and think that everybody's an enemy unless they stand up and declare otherwise. So I have great reservations. On the other hand, you know, I have to be fair. If I was a businessman in Canada and was having trouble with the Americans, their regulations and the holdups at the border and so on, and I thought it was going to facilitate that and make it easier for me to expand my business this side of the border, then I would probably be for it. And I think that's a very valid point. So I'm sort of reserving judgment as to whether we get enough out of it to make the very considerable sacrifices that we are going to have to make insofar as our privacy and our sovereignty are concerned. But I guess the thing that really bothers me most about it is that it's an entrenchment of the idea of Fortress America. In other words, we're going to build a perimeter that's so secure that no one can penetrate it. Well, this is just a fallacy. This is daydreaming. And for serious strategists to put this forward as something real, I think leaves a lot to be desired for their understanding of how the world really works. It reminds me of actually of the Maginot Line. You'll remember that between World Wars I and II, the French thought that they would do something similar. And so they built a fortress right along the border between themselves and Germany that was so powerful that it was impregnable, or so they thought. Well, then, of course, when World War II broke out, the Germans weren't stupid enough to try and go through it. They just went around it. And all of that money and all of that effort was absolutely wasted on a strategy that anybody could almost guarantee was not designed to work. And what we're doing now, in my opinion, is very similar because there's no such thing as you know, a seamless border that can't be penetrated by one means or another. I was reading an interesting piece not too long ago by a retired United States colonel who really agrees with what I'm saying, and or vice versa, I guess we both agree, that anybody who really wanted to penetrate into the United States could do it and could get in, you know, to all of the major coastal cities by one means or another, carrying an atomic bomb. And I'm of the same point of view. I'm sure that if I were directing an assault, if I was on the enemy side and trying to do something like that, that it wouldn't be too difficult to arrange a strategy that would get weapons of mass destruction into the U.S., despite any efforts that they may make to try and make the border impossible to get through. So it's this idea that really bugs me, I guess. And we spend billions and billions of dollars on doing something that is designed presumably to give us security, when in fact that it doesn't. And for me, the only way to end the war on terror is to eliminate the causes for it. These were made very clear to George Bush right at the beginning. You know, after 9/11, the U.S. had the sympathy of almost all of the world, including the great majority of Muslim Arabs and others right around the world. And then they blew it. They had this sympathy, and then by attacking Iraq, which apparently they had already planned to do, they had the plans all put together in the Pentagon, and it was all laid out in advance, and it looked really as if 9/11 was just an excuse to do it, which I guess it really was. Then they blew it because, whereas the threat from Al-Qaeda previous to that was very limited and could easily have been coped with by a combination of police work and good intelligence. But after the attack on Iraq, the number of protesters grew by thousands, you know, from a few dozen to tens of thousands of young Arabs who were willing to give their lives for a cause. And it was made very clear by Osama bin Laden what the problems were, that basically was U.S. meddling in the Middle East and the lack of an even-handed approach to the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. And he told Bush that, and if Bush's advisors really understood what was going on in the world, they would have said, well, if we really want peace, that's the way to go. But one has to conclude that the military-industrial complex, which is really running the United States, and, of course, the international banking cartel is all part of that, that they didn't want peace, that they really wanted war, because with the perpetual war and this all of this money they're spending on perimeters and so on, they make money in their businesses, and it makes promotions in the armed forces, and that these things are paramount in the planning aspects of the Pentagon and the industrial military complex. So I think we're going about it the wrong way. I don't think it's going to produce the results that we want. And consequently, I feel a little bit sorry for both the United States and Canada. When I say that, I mean the people, not the countries per se, but the people who are being hoodwinked into thinking that they have some kind of genuine, real security, when in fact there is no such thing in the kind of world that we live in.
Well, Mr. Hillier, to what extent do you think that the entire war on terror paradigm and the Fortress America concept, as you point out, is being, or at the very least could be used, in a cynical attempt to bring down the national borders of Canada and America to create this continental security perimeter and a sort of de facto North American Union?
I think there is some reason to believe that might be part of it. I have seen and heard about a young lady, for example, who worked in external affairs at the time the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement was signed, who said she actually saw documents that said this is just the first step toward the union of Canada and the United States, and that she was ordered to destroy that document. And now, of course, she's laughed at because that's the way you you deal with people that tell the truth. So I'm not the least bit convinced that it might not be just one more step. One of the negotiators of the free trade agreement actually said that that Canada didn't know what it had signed, that in 20 years they would be sucked into the American economy. Well, I think we were just sucked in, period. And everything is moving in that direction. Everything is being coordinated, and the standards are being adopted, but it's American standards that are being adopted, and practices are being changed to correlate with American practices. And they're proposing some things down there at the moment that are really pretty scary, and which are just the absolute opposite of the habeas corpus and the Bill of Rights and freedom of speech and association that, you know, people fought and died for in two world wars. And so I really am apprehensive and concerned deep down that we're headed in a direction that we really don't want to go in, and that somewhere along the line we're going to have to say enough is enough, and there's too high a price to pay for a few bucks, and we want to have a little more control over our lives and not have our citizens subject to so much scrutiny by people who, well, really have a reputation for being very careless in the way they interpret the information they get from intelligence agencies around the world.
Well, then finally, Mr. Hillier, what would you say to those who argue that in this 21st century interconnected world of instantaneous communication and increasing transborder trade, that the concept and notion of national sovereignty is itself outdated and overrated? What would you say to those arguments?
I would say that this is precisely what the international banking cartel has been planning for 50 years in order to set up a worldwide plutocracy. In other words, the kind of, I hate to use the word, well, I'll use the nice word, totalitarian, in the sense that all of the powers are taken away from us. We have no power to make rules and regulations locally that we want, we think are important for our future, and all of our decisions are made for us by people thousands of miles away who don't care about us and don't understand us and don't really care about trying to understand us because they have their own agenda. And so, to put it bluntly, we're being taken to the cleaners. And this whole idea of free trade, first of all, free trade is really a non sequitur, and especially with the United States, because free trade is, as far as they're concerned, when it doesn't cause them any trouble during the course of a presidential election, and if it's politically difficult, why, they'll find some barrier, some non-tariff barrier to protect their industries, such as they have done recently, of course, with the Buy American Act, which is totally contrary to the concept of free trade between the two countries. And they've done that twice. And then, you know, it's the whole purpose of globalized capital was to allow the richest, most powerful people in the world to extend their influence around the world and to be able to cherry pick the assets of the poor countries more or less at will. And at the same time, as the big multinationals became global, what they did, and this was all part of the plan. They started putting their assets offshore, as we say in the banking business, so that they didn't have to pay tax in their country of origin, and so that they could move the costs and the benefits around in such a way that they would take profits in offshore areas where they don't have to pay any tax or very low taxes, and pay very little of it in those countries, including their own basic country, their own base countries, where they have to pay higher taxes. And you now have a world with a banking system that, well, to put it bluntly, is rotten to the core, and where more than half of world trade is done through offshore bank accounts and virtual bank accounts. And there's a wonderful book that I would recommend to anyone who really wants to know what's going on in the world. It's called Treasure Islands, and it puts down in chapter and verse just what has been going on in the last, three or four decades, and tells how Wall Street and then the City of London, and most people like me didn't know that the City of London is defined as 1 square mile in the middle of the City of London, which claims that it's not subject to British law, and that it has used this ruse, really, to, together with Wall Street, undermine the legitimacy of the banking system worldwide so that they can transfer money around and park the assets of the richest people from all of the countries of the world in some other country where they don't have to pay taxes and where nobody knows what they've got or what they're doing. And this, of course, is one of the major reasons that countries everywhere are having so much trouble balancing their budgets. And that's because neither the multinationals nor the rich people are paying their share of the taxes. And it's not just the rates that you read about that are applicable. It's the fact that they have moved so much of their capital offshore into these virtual areas that they're able to get away with murder as far as paying their fair share is concerned. So the whole international financial system is really one that has to be changed dramatically. And of course, as most people know, I've been spending nearly all of my time on that for a long while, and still am, because we have to get governments back into the business that they should be in, and that's printing and creating at least part of the new money required every year, so that they don't have to borrow money from banks that create the money they use to buy their bonds out of thin air. It's all just the financial system is a house of cards worldwide, and it's no wonder that they're having all this problem with it in Europe at the present time, and especially when both the City of London and Wall Street are deliberately undermining the value of the bonds of the European countries in a deliberate effort to undermine the euro.
So how does the Bank of Canada specifically fit into that international banking architecture?
Well, they're part of it. And this is interesting because from 1939 to 1974, they provided near zero cost money to the Canadian government in very large quantities to get out of the Depression, to help fight the war, and then for the post-war period to help finance the infrastructure like the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Trans-Canada Pipeline, and the great new airport terminals that we built and so on, and to lay the foundation for our Social Security program. Well, then in 1974, our country became one of the members of the Planning Committee and the Bank of International Settlements in Zurich, and I guess they took a decision that they weren't going to provide any more cheap money for governments. And so that ended. This was when they really adopted the ideas of Milton Friedman and his colleagues from the University of Chicago, a basically deregulated, unregulated, worldwide banking cartel, banking system. and of course look at the mess it has created. Well, then the interesting thing, of course, is that governments own the right to create money. Banks don't own it. Banks have no rights. They just have privileges that have been given them by legislators. And those rights can be curbed or taken away. And the governments who own the patents to create money and have those rights on behalf of the people, that's what sovereignty is all about, that they don't use it at all. And when they run out of money, which they inevitably do and under our present system, they have to go cap in hand and borrow financial markets, usually starting with the banks, who then actually create the money to buy those bonds out of thin air. And it's just a rotten system that has to be changed, and it has to be changed now or there's not going to be any real hope for the world.
On that note, then, are there any sources of information, any books or websites you'd like to direct listeners to in regards specifically to this topic of globalization?
Well, I'm specifically in the topic of globalization, I can't think of any. On the monetary thing, there's a victoryfortheworld.net. Several of my books, as you said, are on that subject.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, Mr. Hellyer, I very much appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Not at all. Thank you for calling.